street this evening, and it's tremendous zchut for us at Yeshiva at Ashrenu to have Rabbi Weider here with us this evening. And I want to thank Yeshiva University, Rabbi Cohen, for thinking of us. And always thinking of us and and sharing something very, very special. I go back with Rabbi Weider a long time. I don't know what story is good. I don't know if, I can't vouch for all, but I will say that we're very, very blessed this evening to have him, and I'm blessed to see an old chavruta and an old friend of mine here this evening. So thank you so much. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here. Rabbi Yudin and I go back a very long way to the time when I was a lost-looking freshman in my second semester in YU, an early admissions freshman, and I just transferred to Rosh Hashanah without a chavrusa, and there I was looking for chavrusa, and on the first day I think he found me and said, I'm looking for chavrusa. And the truth is, what he doesn't know is that this shir has its origins in our chavrusa when he wasn't there. So let me explain. You see, he was a smicha, I was a freshman, he was a smicha student, and smicha students in YU at the time, and for many, many years afterwards and before, used to have, during 1 year of smicha, during morning seder, they had a shir by Rav Melech Shechter, Zichrono Lebracha, Rav Shechter's father. The first semester was in Avelus, Hilchos Avelus, you met twice a week for an hour and 15 minutes, and the second semester was Hilchos Nida. Now, I was there second semester, and he always used to tell me how it was so much cheerier a semester that they were studying Hilchos Nida rather than studying Hilchos Avelus. But he wasn't there, justifiably so, during those 2 hour and 15 minute periods of time. And so I had to do something with that time, and obviously it was going to be learning. And Rav Shechter had spoken about something related, very much related to this topic, the Rambam's introduction to the Perush HaMishnayos and the Rambam's theory of the development of Torah Shebaal Peh. And so I figured, oh, the Rambam's Hakdamah of the Perush HaMishnayos, that's a good thing to read. So that's when I read the Rambam's Hakdamah of the Perush HaMishnayos, and that, for this, at least, is sort of the original origins of a piece of this shir. So I don't think that whoever chose the topic realized that when you chose it, but it's kind of at least serendipitous. I begin with a story. The story is told by the Gemara Menachos. The Gemara Menachos tells the following. Picture this. Rabbi Yudin is giving you a shir. And then this old fellow walks in. Turns out you look at his name tag that security gave him. And his name says Moshe Rabbeinu. And he goes and he sits in the back of the room. And imagine he's lost in the middle of the shir. He doesn't understand what's going on. The Gemara tells exactly the story. The Gemara says that quotes in the name of Rabbi Yehuda Marav that Bishar Shalom Moshe Lamar, when Moshe went up to Har Sinai, so Mitzola Kadosh Baruch Hu Sheyoshev Akosher Ksarim Laosios. So Kadosh Baruch Hu was tying crowns on the letters of the Torah. So Moshe Rabbeinu says to him, Ribbono Shalom, Nima Akev Al Yadcha. Who are these for? What are these crowns for? So Kadosh Baruch Hu responds to him and says, Adam Echad Yesh Asid Lios Besov Kamadoros. There's a man who will arise after many generations. The Akiva ben Yosef Shema. Akiva, that's Rabbi Akiva. And he is going to be Doresh on every single crown, every single thorn of the crowns. Tilei Tilun Shal Halachos. Piles, mounds and mounds of laws. He's going to expound and interpret based upon these kotzim. So Moshe Rabbeinu says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hareuli, I want to see him. So what happens? turns around and Moshe Rabbeinu finds himself in Rabbi Akiva's base medrash. And he's listening to the shir, and the Gemara says, V'lo ha-yodea ma'ayim ha-yomim. But Moshe Rabbeinu could not follow the shir. So that's, of course, as an aside, always provides hope that if you find yourself in a difficult situation you're not following, Moshe Rabbeinu also once didn't follow, and eventually he was Rabban Shokal Yisrael. So Toshash Kocho, he felt terrible. Amr lo Talmidav, then at some point Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim asked him about a particular halacha. Minayin lach, how do you know this particular law? And as you built up this whole shir, and this one core principle that you started with, where's that come from? He said to his Talmidim, halacha l'moshe misinai. Nisyashva datu, Moshe Rabbeinu felt better. Seems, obviously, a very, very odd story. It's odd that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't follow Rabbi Akiva's shir, but it's even odder that that the shir was based upon, its root was based upon something that was halacha l'moshe misinai, and yet Moshe Rabbeinu didn't follow the shir at all. Now, it's not the interpretation I'm going to follow today, but interestingly enough, and only years later did I discover, I looked in Rashi, of all things, all places, you never think to look there, and Rashi says that's because HaKadosh Baruch Hu hadn't given the Torah yet. Okay. But the Rambam, as we will see, has a very, very different interpretation of the story, and the story serves as the proof text for the Rambam's entire view of the development of how Torah Shebaal Peh develops. Now, classically speaking, the way we tend to think of Torah Shebaal Peh is the way it's formulated in the Medrash Halacha that we have to Sefer Vayikra, known as Torah Kohanim or the Sifra, which Rashi quotes very frequently. You may know it, you may have encountered this Rashi, and Rashi quotes this, the Torah Kohanim, I put the Torah Kohanim here, the Sifra, which comments on the first pasuk of Parshas Bahar. You know, the Torah begins Bahar, and you have Bar Mitzvah Parshas Bahar? No chance? Okay. Statistical odds, I might have gotten someone, but okay. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe Behar Sinai Lemor. Now, what is strange about that pasuk? What is striking? Well, what would you say is the most common pasuk in the Torah? Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe Lemor. That occurs numerous times. What's odd about this pasuk, obviously? It says Behar Sinai. Take the words Behar Sinai out and you have Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Lemor. So the Medrash Halacha on Vayikra, the Sifra, immediately asks, Ma inyan Shemitah Eitzel Har Sinai? The Behar is about, the beginning of Behar is about the laws of Shemitah. Why Shemitah, of all things, does the Torah have to tell us Behar Sinai Lemor? As opposed to maybe Shabbos, you know, maybe Negoim, but all those say Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Lemor. Here it's Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Behar Sinai Lemor. So the Sifra in Rashi quotes this in his Perush, says that Elamash Mita Nemru Klalosea Vidiktu Keha Misinai, Afkulam Nemru Klalosea Vidiktu Keha Misinai. Just as by Shemitah, where the Torah actually spells out a lot of the laws of Torah in Torah Shebichzav, Shemitah has far more details in it, in the written Torah, than most areas of Halacha do, but just as Shemitah, all of its rules and its details are from Sinai, so too all of the other halachos, the klalim and the pratim, the diktukim, all of it is misinai. So classically, we tend to think that Torah Shebichzav and Torah Shebichzav is obvious, but Torah Shebaal Peh is also comes completely misinai. In a similar fashion, although difficult to understand in certain ways, the Gemara in Brachos quotes the pasuk at the end of Parshas Mishpatim when HaKadosh Baruch Hu asks Moshe to come up to Har Sinai, and he says, "I'm going to give you So, because of the verbosity, because of the extra words, because of the full expression, what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to give him as luchos ha'aven v'ha'torah v'ha'mitzvah asher kasafti lahorosam. So the Gemara in Brachos darshins from each word a particular additional thing that a particular thing that Moshe Rabbeinu was given. So the luchos are the luchos ha'aven, ha'torah is all of Torah Shebichzav, ha'mitzvah is the Mishnah, I think. And in the Gemara also includes Nevi'im and Ksuvim. I don't understand what that means actually, because I presume Moshe Rabbeinu didn't come down with the art scroll Tanakh. I don't know how you could have had Nevi'im and Ksuvim yet, but okay. And then the Gemara says that Lahorosam is the Talmud, so Moshe Rabbeinu was given Torah Shebichzav, he was given the Mishnah, he was given the Talmud, everything he's given at Sinai. So that is the way, at least agadically, that the Gemara formulates the transmission or the reception of Torah Shebaal Peh. Now, we're going to skip many generations now, to an issue that sort of was consumed the medieval period, the early medieval period, with a major debate between the Gaonim and the Rambam. Now, for those of you who, some of you may have encountered the Gaonim, a Gaon, today they use the expression, he's a Gaon, he's a genius. But the term originally Gaon referred to a head of one of the two Babylonian academies, you know, running from the period after the Gemara down, you know, the Gaonit ended probably around the time of the Rambam. It had certainly declined in stature greatly by the time of the Rambam. But for probably from the year 600 to the year 1000, the Gaonit was the central institution of Torah for world Jewry. And all questions went to Bavel, to the Gaonim to answer. And you probably have heard of a few of the famous Gaonim. You've probably heard of Sadia Gaon, maybe Rav Hai Gaon, some of the well-known Gaonim whose works we have. Rav Hai, I assume, is a name that some of you might have encountered. He's one probably the last very prominent Gaon. His father's name was Sharira Gaon. And that was his father. That was his father's name. And Rav Sharira Gaon was the author of the very important letter that was written to the Jews of Kairouan, which is in, I think, Tunisia, where there was a Jewish community, and they asked them a series of very obvious questions that I'd imagine anybody starting to learn in the Beis Medrash might ask, which is, how was the Mishnah written? How was the Gemara written? How did these things come about? So usually you have an idea that Rebbe was somehow responsible for the Mishnah, Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi. Maybe you think Ravina Rav Ashi were responsible for the Talmud Bavli. But they asked, sort of, that's the way we tend to think. And they asked him this very basic questions. These very basic questions. And one of the things that troubled them was that if you look at the early, you look at the names that are found in the Mishnah, who are the common Tanoim that are found? So you know that there's some very early Tanoim, like Shammai and Hillel themselves, and they're not found very frequently in the Mishnah, and they don't argue very much. You know, Shammai and Hillel argue in three places in the Mishnah. If you go back before Shammai and Hillel, you know, maybe from the beginning of Maseches Avos, you have the Zugos, right? You have the five generations of Anasi and Anab Beis Din, like Shammai and Avtalion, like Shimon ben Shetach and Yehuda ben Tabai. There are five generations there, and if those Tanoim, of those four generations, Shammai and Hillel were the last. Of those five generations, the four that precede Shammai and Hillel, there's exactly one machlokas recorded between those figures. It's the same Mishnah and Chagiga. It's the same issue generation after generation, whether when you would bring a karban on Yom Tov, whether or not you could do smicha on Yom Tov. But no other place do we find these figures arguing. So the question they wanted to know was, why is it in the fact that you have all this argument later in the Mishnah, but the earlier Tanoim don't argue very much, and we don't hear their names very often? In a certain sense, what the question really boils down to is, what is the origin of Machlokas? Why is there Machlokas in the Mishnah? In fact, I don't know if this is true, but you know what parak of Mishnah in theory that you might say every day if you say Karbanos? It's found at the end of Karbanos? At the end of Karbanos? Even that might give us some way. Ezehu Makoman. It's the fifth parak in Zvachim. I've never checked this myself, but I've heard it claimed that that fifth parak in Zvachim is the only parak in all of Shas that there is no machlokas. Don't know if it's true, but I know there's no machlokas in that parak. I don't know if there's any other prakim in Shas like that, but of the 523 or 25, depending on how you count prakim, that's the only one they say that there's no machlokas. Machlokas is ubiquitous. It's all over the place. Why is there so much machlokas other than the fact that the Jews like to argue? So what is the origin of machlokas? To answer that question, the Gaonim, and Rashur Gaon probably represents the general Gaonic view, presents a certain model. The Rambam took very, very strong exception to that model. Now, if I'm going to sort of throw this one out at you. If you had to explain the origin of Machlokas, what would you say? How did it come about? Take a guess. Because there are really two models, two ways of explaining Machlokas, one which is chosen by the Gaonim, one which is chosen by the Rambam. So what would you say? Okay, you walk out of Shir, and there's a... Yes?
Maybe one rabbi saw that a rabbi in earlier times wrote something, he didn't agree with that, so he argued against that point, and it was written down.
Okay, so I didn't frame the question well, so let me ask, you know... That's a fair answer, but then let me ask you a question. What is the nature of the particular law they're arguing about? Is it a tradition received, or is it somebody's own svara? So the way you're forming it have to be that there's a machlokas in svara and something that wasn't a received tradition.
Right.
So if you were to think about that, if you had a particular law in the Mishnah that were a din d'oraisa, would you think that to be possible?
I guess not.
So you could guess either way and you'd be right, because there's more than one opinion on that. But your instincts, I think, at least the way we typically think, are correct. In other words, if it's midoraisa, then it must be a tradition, and therefore that can't be the explanation. So if, let's go with your guess and take that to the next step, what's the alternative as the origin of machlokas? You had a suggestion?
Maybe that, as it's being passed down orally, that two rabbis said different things, but it stemmed from one thing, so I guess the machlokas is trying to get back to the original statement.
So you would describe it as confusion or maybe error in transmission.
Yeah.
Okay, so those basically... We have to explain your suggestion, because yours is the Rambam suggestion, your suggestion is the Gaonim suggestion, but those are sort of the two basic approaches that were developed to explain the origin of Machlokas. Now, the reason why the Rambam objected so strongly to the Gaonic view that Machlokas emerges because people didn't get things properly is because he felt that undermines sort of the veracity of Torah. If there are so many things that people forgot and got confused over, so you're basically undermining all you're undermining a lot of Torah Sheba'al Peh that way. Now, one of the interesting things about this machlokas is that, as most machlokas between Mishonim, it boils down to the interpretation of one particular text. Now, what particular text is that? It's a text on the back of the sheet. In that text, the Tosefta, which is found in Chagiga and Sanhedrin, Rabbi Yosei, the Tana, describes the process of legal decision-making. Now, lahavdil a little bit, but it's nonetheless a very good analogy. The picture that Rabbi Yosei paints is very similar to what I describe as the American court system, with sort of one exception. Normally, when you have a court in American law, so when you go to court, typically, the regular court that you go to really fundamentally determines one thing. It's a determination of fact. And that's why usually, not always usually, you have a jury, and the jury decides on what the facts were. The judge instructs the jury as to what the law is. And based upon that law, they determine what the facts were, and then the application is usually very straightforward. So if they're trying someone off for murder, the judge defines to them what is murder, what is first-degree murder in civil law, and the jury looks at the facts and says, okay, this was or wasn't premeditated, this or that, and they decide based upon the judge's definitions. If there is a question of what the law is, or there's a challenge to the law, so in America, you can't challenge, generally speaking, the finding of facts of a jury. And a higher court will never overturn the jury's finding on facts as a general rule. But what can you challenge? You can challenge either the procedure, whether the judge conducted the court proceedings properly, or sometimes you can challenge the law. You can claim the law is not constitutional, or it's an incorrect interpretation of the law. And what happens when it happens? Well, you go to a higher court. Now, what happens? The higher court rules in a certain fashion, and what happens if you don't like that ruling? Well, then you appeal to the up the chain until eventually you might get to the Supreme Court if they agree to hear the case. So the process that Rabbi Yossi describes essentially is exactly that. Well, and it's really describing the psukim in Parsha Shoftim. The Torah says, "Ki yipalei mimcha davar la'mishpat, bein dam ladam, bein din ladim, bein nega la'nega, divrei rivos b'sharecha." What happens if something is concealed from you in various matters of Jewish law? What do? V'kam tovi alisa la'makom asher yivchar Hashem elokecha bo. You go up to Yerushalayim and you get a psak from the Beis Din HaGadol. So what Rabbi Yossi describes here actually is the chain of appellate courts. If the Beis Din in your city doesn't know, you go to Yerushalayim. At the entrance to the Harabayis, there's one court of 23. You bring them the question. If they can't determine the ruling, it gets bumped up to the next Beis Din of 23 at the entrance to the Azara. And if they can't decide, or they haven't heard the law, you go to the Sanhedrin. And then if the Sanhedrin has a received tradition, the Sanhedrin will inform you, this is the law we have received. If they don't, then they have to decide what the law is. So they have discussion, and they have a debate, and eventually they take a head count, and they follow the majority ruling. At the end of the Tosefta states, assumes that this is how things always work. And then when you get to the end, it says, Misherabu Talmidei Shammai v'Hillel Shaloshim Shukol Tzarkon Rav Samachlokes B'Yisrael V'Nasu Shtei Toros. From when you had the many Talmidim of Shammai and Hillel who were not mishamesh kol tzarkon sufficiently, it's not clear what that means. So then machlokes exploded, the amount of machlokes, and it became like two toros. Now that's a factual description. Up until Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, just read the Mishnah. It's the data is in front of you. There's very little machlokes. Comes Beis Shammai, Beis Hillel, and subsequently there's a ton of machlokes. So the question is, what happened? Meaning, what does it mean? Talmidei Shammai Shelo Shimshu Kol Tzarkon. That's what it all boils down to. So your suggestion before is the one that I think we intuitively gravitate to, which is that part of learning from a Rebbe is not just learning, but it's Shimush. You know, it means spending time around the Rebbe, watching his particular behaviors, because there's a lot to be learned. And so if they didn't do Shimush properly, it means they didn't learn properly, which means I saw Rebbe do X. No, you're wrong. I saw Rebbe do Y, and nobody asked him what exactly he was doing. So it sounds like there's some type of error in transmission. That, in fact, has how Rav Shmuel Gaon interprets. So Rav Shmuel Gaon, in fact, says, he says, the reason there was no machlokes, I'm not going to read it, it's a difficult Aramaic. Rav Shmuel Gaon says that in the early days of the early Tanaim, whose names we barely know, or maybe some who we haven't even heard of, who are anonymous, there basically was no machlokas because there was no formal text of the Mishnah. It was all oral in the sense not only was it not written down, but there wasn't a formal fixed law. You can have Mishnayos Baal Peh, but that's an oral text. But it was purely each Rebbe taught his Talmud the way he thought appropriate, and they all conveyed the same ideas, and there was no machlokas. That's what Rav Shmuel Gaon says. And then what happened? What happened was, with all the persecutions in the time of the Churban of the second Beis HaMikdash, and then the destruction of Beitar, with all the dislocation and all the persecution and all the exiles, people didn't have time to learn properly. And therefore, people got confused. And that's why you have all the machlokas Beis Shammai, Beis Hillel, and from there, it breaks down. That is position number one. The Rambam was very not happy about this, as I mentioned before. And the Rambam develops an entirely different thesis based upon the Gemara Menachos that I began with, and based upon his interpretation of what it means, Misharabu Tamidei V'Shamai V'Hillel Shloshim Shukol Tzarkan. You see, because I sort of hinted to one part that's in the Tosefta, and the Tosefta says that, I did sort of say this, if they heard that the Sanhedrin HaGadol, Shamu, if they had a received Shmua, they had a received tradition, they would tell the people, this is what we have received, you know, from Moshe Misena, we received it from Arabim, who presumably received it from their Abim. But if they didn't, Omdim Biminyan, they would take a head count, they would vote. How do you think the halacha should be? Now that we don't have a received tradition, what appears more logical to you? And basically, they would follow majority rule. So the Rambam says that there are five categories of Torah Shebal Peh. If you were to take all the dinim that are included in Torah Shebal Peh and break them down, they fall into five categories. The Rambam, by the way, also repeats this categorization in the Mishneh Torah in the beginning of Hilchos Mamrim, but it's harder to see it there. It's buried there, and if you've read this, if you read his introduction, his commentary in the Mishnah, and then you read Hilchos Mamrim, you'll see it much more clearly. So what are the five categories? So two for the moment I'm not interested in discussing, because there are two kinds of dinim derabanan. Two kinds of gzeros, takanos, whatever exactly they are, but that's not of interest right now. Because we know that obviously takanos derabanan don't come misina. By definition, they're not minatora, they develop, we often know when a gzera was made, but typically most of the gzeros that we know of were made sometime in the period of the Tanaim or in the period of the Amoraim. But it's the first three categories that the Rambam presents that are most of interest for our discussion. The Rambam says that category number one are things that we call halacha l'moshe misinai. What characterizes halacha l'moshe misinai are laws that, number one, have no connection to Torah Shebichtav. They don't relate to any interpreting a word in the pasuk. They don't interpret to anything that stems directly from the pasuk. They stand totally separate from Torah Shebichtav. For example, there's a principle known, what Masechta are you learning? What's that?
Brachos.
Okay. I don't know if I'm going to pull anything out of there. Okay, so I'll pull something out of sukkah. Okay, you're building a sukkah and you're building a wall. So you need three walls or two and a half walls, right? Let's say my walls have gaps in it. It's not solid. You know, like a fence, you know, a chain link fence. So am I allowed to have gaps in the wall? Does the wall have to be absolutely solid? The answer is no. You're allowed to have gaps of up to three tvachim, and if it's less than three tvachim, based upon the principle of Lovin, we assume that it's solid. Okay, you can make an entire sukkah that way, actually. It might not be very comfortable to sit in, but you could take a bunch of poles, put them close together, and you could build your walls that way, and that's perfectly kosher. That principle is known as lavud, and the Gemara says that principle, that you can view a gap in the laws of sukkah, and in some other areas, maybe in Hilchos Shabbos, as closed and forming a solid mechitza, that principle is halacha l'moshe misinai. There's no pasuk that hints anywhere to lavud. It's a necessary principle, because in real life you can't make a mechitza without holes in it. It's virtually impossible without some gap. But it's halacha l'moshe misinai. It doesn't relate to anything explicit in the pasuk. The Rambam claims that when it comes to things that are called halacha l'moshe misinai, they come misinai, as the words would imply, and you'll never find any machlokas. Because people didn't forget things. People didn't confuse things in the transmission. That's category one. Category two are what the Rambam terms Perushim HaMekubalim, received interpretations. For example, what does the Torah say to take on Sukkot, on the first day of Sukkot? What does the Torah say he's supposed to take? It says L'kachtem lachem bayom harishon. I'm going to skip the next three words. Kapos tamarim. That's pretty obvious what it means. Palm branches. Va'anaf etz avos and hadasim and arve nachal. Those are pretty clear. But the Torah also says something called Pri Eitz Hadar. What is Pri Eitz Hadar? The fruit, either the beautiful fruit of a tree or the fruit of a beautiful tree. What is a Pri Eitz Hadar? So you all know, obviously, when you go before Sukkot, that your Pri Eitz Hadar is an Esrog. The Gemara has a number of very novel interpretations. How do we know that Priyetz Hadar means Esrog? Including one interpretation that says that an Esrog apparently grows on all water. I don't know exactly what that means botanically. It's Godel al Kolmayim, and the word Hudar in Greek is the same word as English water. Okay? Priyetz Hudar. That's how they read it. One interpretation reads it as a Greek word. There are various interpretations. But everybody agrees. Everybody agrees that a Priyetz Hadar is an Esrog. So the Rambam says that Priyetz Hadar is an Esrog, that's received in Sinai. Everybody knew that from the time the Torah was given, that's what Priyetz Hadar means. Everybody knew that Ayin Tachas Ayin doesn't mean you poke the guys out. What does it mean? You pay money. The Gemara in Bava Kama has 8 different interpretations. How do you know Ayin Tachas Ayin is money? And it's not to be taken literally, but nobody disagrees with the fact that Ayin Tachas Ayin is not mamish. It's not literal. So the Rambam says those are things that are Perushim HaMekubalim, and he says you will never find Machlokas there either. The Rambam then says, category number 3, if you have something, and it may not be limited to this, but if you have something that you find the Machlokas about, and it's a law which is Min HaTorah, not Midrabanan, the Rambam says it means that the law is not from Moshe at Sinai. It's a law that develops later. Now, how do you get a machlokas? So the Rambam says, how do these laws develop? So again, I'll choose my analogy, Lahavdil, the Supreme Court. You have a new case that's never been dealt with before. It comes up. How does the Supreme Court decide? And the Torah describes this description, by the way, the process in Parsha Shoftim. But how does the American Supreme Court decide? What do? They read the Constitution. They study case law and all the precedents that they have, but it's still a new case, and they put it all together, and they say, so I think that based upon that, this is what the law should be. Well, guess what? Justice Scalia thinks one thing, and probably Justice Ginsburg can almost certainly think the opposite thing, and different people have different ways of analyzing it based upon whatever principles of interpretation they use. That may sound familiar, midos ha'Torah nidrashos b'hen, and there were disputes about which midos you're supposed to use and when you use them. And based upon that, and based upon Svara, they come up with different interpretations. So the Rambam says that the only time machlokes can emerge and exist by laws min HaTorah is things that weren't given to Moshe at Sinai. It's not that they're lost in transmission. It's that new cases come up and different judges see things differently. The Rambam believes that in a perfect world where everybody had a perfect intellect, they would all reach the same conclusion. But the Rambam acknowledges not everybody's, you know, of equal ability, and therefore even great people, some are greater than others, and they come up with different interpretations. Now, for the Rambam, though, you still have to explain one thing. Why is it that Machlokes only emerges after a certain point? So the Rambam says that what happened with Talmidim of Shammai and Hillel is not that they didn't learn from their Rabbeim, and they didn't hear correctly and remember correctly. It's that they had new issues that came up, but it used to be the resolution mechanism for conflict worked. Everybody understood. You took a vote, and the majority won. And that mechanism, for whatever reason, broke down in the days of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. And once it broke down, so no people couldn't come to a conclusion, so you had Beis Shammai say this, and Beis Hillel said that. And that's how the Rambam says Machlokas, numerically speaking, explodes. What that means for the Rambam, though, and that's really a stunning revelation, is that there is a lot of Torah Shebaal Peh, a lot of laws that we consider midaraisa min HaTorah, and they are min HaTorah, which don't come Sinai. It means you can have a law that has the status of deoraisa for all with all the ramifications in that, and yet it doesn't come from Moshe at Sinai, and it's still midaraisa. Now, when you go back, you now can understand the story with Rabbi Akiva. And Moshe Rabbeinu in the Beis Medrash of Rabbi Akiva. Now it all makes sense. And this was one of the Rambam's chief proofs, is that Moshe Rabbeinu only sort of knew the law at its core. He knew the halacha of Moshe Mishinai. That was familiar to him. But he couldn't know every single scenario and every law that was going to develop and grow out of that. So he steps into Akiva's Beis Medrash, and he's hearing a discussion, you know, Chatzi Nezek and Nezek Shalem and Sroros. Well, that might be Halacha Moshe Mishinai, but he's hearing all the, you know, every fancy machlokes. He doesn't understand what's going on. He's never heard of these principles because they weren't issues for him. So he feels terrible. And then he hears that how do you know the core of the Shir, the base principle which out of the Shir grows out of? Halacha Moshe Mishinai, and he felt better. So that is basically the Rambam's thesis on how to understand the development of Torah Shebaal Peh. And its model, I think, is a very good, it's a logical model, it's one that we recognize from many human legal systems. And even though the Torah is divine, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Torah to people, lo b'shamayim hi. And if you think about American constitutional law, conceptually speaking, it's the very same model as the Rambam outlines. It's one that I think almost every legal system, in effect, has to go through, because legal systems have to develop, otherwise they become, in a sense, irrelevant. There's a very interesting sefer. The introduction is probably known by more people than the sefer is, and Reb Shechter likes to quote this a lot. It's called the Dor Revi on Chulin. It was written in the early 20th century by the Kloisenberger Rav, not the Kloisenberger Rebbe. The Kloisenberger Rav was a misnagin. His books were on the banned books list of Satmar because he was a rarity in pre-World War II Hungary. He was a Zionist. It was very unusual. So all his books were on the banned list from Satmar. And he has a sefer on Chulin called Dor Revi. It's a sefer chidushim. But most people who know anything about it know the Hakdama. They know the introduction. And in the introduction, and I'm not going to talk about this part, the Dor Revi is interested in a very fundamental question that I guess everybody in the Beis Medrash should ask. The people of Kairouan never asked Sri Ragon this question, but if I could have asked, I would have asked this question. The probably most accepted and core principle of all of Psak Halacha is that there is one source which is the final word and is binding like nothing else. And what is that? Anybody know? What is the truly binding source in terms of halacha? It's not the Shulchan Aruch. Achronim argue in the Shulchan Aruch. There's only one source that you can't argue on. And that if you find a proof in that source for your position or against your position, that is definitive and that's the final word. And that source is the Talmud Bavli. The question is, and you read every discussion of Rishonim and Halacha and in Shulchan Aruch, there may be chumras that develop after the Bavli, but that is the core principle of all halachic decision making, is that you can argue on the Achronim. You can't, I don't advise it, but Achronim will argue on the Shulchan Aruch. There even Achronim will sometimes argue on the Rishonim. But you cannot argue on the Bavli. The Bavli is binding as the final word. And the question is, why? Why is that so? So he offers his own novel interpretation. But in the process, he talks about the fact that Torah Shebaal Peh is by its nature dynamic and flexible and adaptable. He points to something that I would have totally missed. When the Torah, which is the foundation of the Shulchan Aruch, was written by the Rush's son, when the Torah talks about Birchos HaTorah, the Nusach of Birchos HaTorah, we say, Asher Nosa Lanu Toras Emes V'chaye Olam Nata B'Sochenu. So the Torah says that Toras Emes is Torah Shebichsav. That's a written Torah. That's a written text. Chaye Olam, eternal life, that's Torah Shebaal Peh. So the Dor Revi explains, what's the difference? So he says that when you have a written text by its nature is much less flexible, it's much less dynamic, it's much less subject to multiple interpretations. Not that you can't have multiple interpretations, but it's much more rigid. Torah Shebichsav, he says, we couldn't live by Torah Shebichsav alone. We would become a dinosaur, we'd become fossilized, because it's inflexible and not dynamic. What makes Torah a living for Klal Yisrael is that it's Chaye Olam Nata B'Sochein, it's Torah Shebaal Peh, that allows the Torah to be interpreted and understood appropriately in every generation for that generation. So that's how he talks, so he relates that somehow to why the Talmud Bavli became binding. But he obviously recognizes that this is both the strength and the weakness of Torah Shebaal Peh, because you realize, and this is really a kasha in the Rambam, if in fact Torah Shebaal Peh is flexible and dynamic and has to make the Torah relevant in every generation, so to what extent is Torah Shebaal Peh, the development, influenced by our surroundings and our society? And so the Dor Revi, which is an obvious question, right? So to some extent it may be true, it is, but the Dor Revi explains that that's the whole point of a Sanhedrin, that's the whole point of halachic decision makers, that's the whole point of Chachmei HaMasorah. The Chachmei HaMasorah are in charge of deciding which interpretations are within the pale, and which interpretations are, and even if it's influenced, even if it's subject to the world in which we live, and which interpretations are outside of the pale. Yes, it's potentially dangerous, but it's also what gives Torah its living quality, its dynamism, its relevance, its adaptability to every single circumstance, to every single generation. So that is, in that sense, I find the Rambam's interpretation of the development of Torah Shebaal Peh a much more appealing concept, because it sort of relates to the world that we know. It also relates to legal systems that we know. But fundamentally speaking, this whole discussion originates in a machlokes of how machlokas originates. And the view of the Gaonim, for whatever reason, is that the material of Torah Sheba'al Peh was all known from an early period of time, and machlokas that develops because people were confused over the transmission. It's a much more static and less dynamic view of Torah Sheba'al Peh. But the Rambam's view is that the nature of Torah Sheba'al Peh fundamentally is developmental, and what we received at Sinai is Torah Shebichsav, plus the core of Torah Sheba'al Peh, those things that are Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai, those things that are specific interpretations of Sukkim, and then everything naturally grows out of that through the interpretations of the Sanhedrin, through the applications of the various principles we use to interpret Torah Shebichsav, combined with those things that we received at Torah Sheba'al Peh. And so that is, in a nutshell, sort of the machlokas, an old machlokas of exactly the origin or the nature of Torah Sheba'al Peh and what we received at Sinai and what came later. Any questions?